You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
My pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker today, a friend and mentor, Avril Haines. Avril is currently a senior research scholar at Columbia University, where she is working to harness academic breakthroughs to address societal challenges. Prior to that, she was Deputy National Security Advisor for President Obama, where she was an active participant in all discussions relating to North Korea. She's also served as Deputy Director at the Central Intelligence Agency, Legal Advisor to the National Security Council, and performed roles in the Department of State, the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, the Hague Conference on Private International Law, and as a law clerk in the Sixth Circuit. Avril will deliver a keynote address, after which she has kindly agreed to take questions. Thanks.
So now that you've had some lunch and you're ready to go to sleep, I'm going to try to set the stage. All right. I really want to thank Brookings, and not just for organizing and hosting the discussion today, but for all the remarkable work, frankly, that they've been doing on this issue and so many others to ensure that the policy community remains thoughtful, informed, agile in approaching the toughest national security and foreign policy challenges that we face today in an ever-increasingly complex world. And the discussion, I'd say, this morning, pulled together by Bruce and Ryan and Jung, with some of the most thoughtful people that I know on this subject, was particularly fascinating and worthwhile, which is frankly saying something when it comes to North Korea, given that as many people in this room know, we've been talking about this for a long time, and it's not a small challenge to say something that's new or different or even just interesting, given the amount of ink and digital space that's been spilt over the years in an effort to identify a sort of successful path forward. So with that introduction, I should warn you that I, too, have nothing new to say on this subject. But I favor a particular combination of really old ideas, which I hope to convince you is the right approach. In short, I think three lines of effort need to be engaged in at the same time. First, I think we should continue to increase diplomatic and economic pressure on the DPRK to bring Kim Jong-un to the table and secure a freeze as the first step in a phased approach that might ultimately lead to denuclearization. Secondly, I think we should continually coordinate our efforts with our allies and engage in contingency planning with China, the Republic of Korea, and Japan in the event of a collapse of the regime. And third, we should engage in activities intended to support the people of North Korea when doing so, that does not significantly detract from the pressure campaign, highlight the human rights abuses of the regime, and get information to the people of North Korea regarding the outside world. So this isn't really a change from where we were at the end of the Obama administration, but I would argue that there is a greater chance for this combination to succeed now than ever before because of key shifts in the landscape over the last several years. But first, I'm going to start by explaining why I think this is the right approach. As I see it, administrations on a bipartisan basis have tended to agree on many, if not all, of the key policy objectives that we're after. One, freezing North Korea's nuclear weapons program with the ultimate goal of rolling back the program to achieve a denuclearized Korean peninsula. Two, preventing the additional proliferation of nuclear weapons information and material from North Korea to other actors. Three, reassuring our allies such that, among other things, they don't pursue nuclear weapons themselves. And four, ensuring that our efforts with respect to North Korea do not weaken other key U.S. policy objectives, including our more general efforts to counter proliferation of nuclear weapons around the world. So thus far, in an effort to achieve these objectives, both Democratic and Republican administrations have implemented an approach in which we've aggressively pursued economic and diplomatic pressure on the DPRK with the stated goal of bringing them to the negotiating table. all the while recognizing that we cannot create enough pressure to do this through unilateral sanctions, and that the key player is China, given that approximately 90% of North Korea's international trade is with China. So consequently, the principal mechanism for pursuing effective sanctions has really been through the United Nations. And since 2006, at the instigation of the United States, the Security Council has adopted 8 resolutions over the years that impose increasingly onerous sanctions on North Korea, including severe limits on weapons trade, banking, other financial transactions, some of which we've talked about today. And I'd argue that we need to continue to pursue such pressure, both by enacting new sanctions and by doing everything we can to encourage full enforcement of existing sanctions. And I support the Trump administration's efforts in this regard. Nevertheless, such pressure has to be combined with other policy initiatives if it's to have plausible success. But before I get to those other policy initiatives, I want to take just a moment to talk about the reasons for supporting diplomatic and economic pressure versus, for example, military action, which has been discussed. I realize that given the current pitch of concern driven in part by the ratcheting up of the rhetoric, 15 missile tests since President Trump took office, including an ICBM, and a 6 nuclear test, people are questioning whether we can and should continue to exercise the patience necessary for applying pressure. Some suggest that rather than continue what they perceive to be a failing policy, we should take some limited preemptive strike against the regime to demonstrate that we are in fact willing to take military action, perhaps against known nuclear facilities. I won't get into the question of whether I think such a strike could effectively destroy the DPRK ballistic missile threat capacity or its nuclear weapon facilities or weapons, but instead I would just point to Chairman Dunford's statement this summer, with which I agree, that while a military option is not unimaginable, it would surely be horrific and would lead to, quote, a loss of life unlike any we have experienced in our lifetimes. Furthermore, it would be hard to imagine how such a strike would achieve the policy objectives I identified. Surely, given everything we know about Kim Jong-un, no one doubts that he would be inclined to respond with force in order to deter us from further action, and to prove that he cannot be pushed around. A non-response would be perceived as weak, might lead to his overthrow, and in the face of such action, he would have even less incentive, if that is possible, to give up his nuclear weapons. Additionally, China would be under substantial pressure to support the North in such a situation, given their mutual defense pact with the North. And what message, for example, would it send to China's partners and prospective allies if China did not respond to an attack on their ally that was not in response to an armed attack, even if Pyongyang had engaged in threatening language and rhetoric? In other words, we should be clear, as the chairman was, that there are no costless military options here that would address the threat we are facing. And while military action may seem appealing because the alternative seems less than satisfying as we watch the DPRK continue to pursue an increasingly improved nuclear weapon capability while we apply pressure, we should be careful not to get caught up in the need to look and feel strong and instead act with strength. As Sun Tzu said, the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that military action should be off the table. No U.S. president has ever taken it off the table, and I wouldn't recommend that we do so now. But I do not believe we have come nearly close enough to exhausting other options, and in fact, a number of trends may assist our efforts in applying pressure such that we will see better results over the next several years than we have seen in the past. And moreover, although the North Koreans have reached yet another milestone in their development of deliverable nuclear weapons with the launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, little else has materially changed. With approximately 30,000 U.S. soldiers on the peninsula with their families, we were before and are now still in a situation in which Pyongyang could attack the United States and its allies, causing a terrible loss of life. And in my view, Kim Jong-un has little incentive to do so, though it is possible that he can be goaded into doing so. Another common criticism to this approach comes from those who argue that pressure makes no sense because no amount of pressure will convince Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear weapons, which he recognizes as being key to his remaining in power. And in fact, I think that is likely true, but as I see it, that is not the only reason to engage in a pressure campaign. Among other things, even if you assume that Kim Jong-un will never come to the table, no matter how dire the circumstances, to negotiate in good faith a full rollback of the DPRK's nuclear weapons program, he may be willing to come to the negotiating table to negotiate a freeze and perhaps over time additional measures such as inspections that would allow for a slowdown of the North's nuclear program, which would be worth it in the short term as we pursue other aspects of a broader policy intended to achieve denuclearization. In fact, the DPRK's foreign minister indicated in 2016 that they would be willing to suspend nuclear tests if the United States stopped conducting its annual military exercises with South Korea, and both China and Russia have stated their support for such an approach. And while I would not agree to a freeze for freeze along these lines, I do agree with the idea that attempting a phased approach to denuclearization that starts with an interim freeze on the DPRK's ballistic missile and nuclear capabilities, in exchange perhaps for certain modifications to the military exercises that do not reduce our readiness when it comes to defending our ally, the Republic of Korea, is worth considering. We should be clear-eyed, however, about how difficult this approach will be. During any such negotiation, the North will argue that we should not continue to apply pressure against them and that sanctions should be suspended during the course of negotiations. Yet, of course, if we pull back too far, there will be little incentive for the DPRK to agree to anything, and instead they will try to find ways to extend the negotiations. In my view, efforts should be made to agree in advance with China on continuing to engage in robust implementation of sanctions during the course of negotiations, if not the addition of new sanctions depending on certain conditions. And doing so will also help convince our allies that such an engagement is not foolhardy. Another challenge to this approach will be that engaging in such a negotiation risks appearing to accept the DPRK as a nuclear weapon state, which would undercut our nonproliferation efforts more generally and potentially incentivize bad behavior. But to mitigate against this concern, we should do what we can to make clear that any initial freeze is part of a phased approach intended, at least from our perspective, to lead to a full denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And finally, any adjustments we make are incentives that we offer during the course of the negotiations are likely to be concerning to our allies. And so we would need to convince them of the value of this approach and closely coordinate on our discussions to bring them along with the reassurance that they will know what we are doing at every step of the way. But as I stated earlier, a pressure campaign must be combined with two other lines of effort, one of which is to continually coordinate with our allies and in particular engage in contingency planning with China, Korea, and Japan in the event of a collapse of the regime. I don't think we can rely exclusively on a phased approach to achieve our principal objective, which is to roll back North Korea's nuclear program. And while not impossible, it is highly unlikely that the phased approach will lead to the DPRK willingly giving up its nuclear weapons in the near term. What seems far more likely is that over the next several years, the regime collapses, Kim Jong-un is overthrown, or an ally successfully pursues regime change. And under such circumstances, it is not clear whether anyone that attempts to replace Kim Jong-un will be more likely to engage in good faith negotiations to achieve denuclearization. But particularly in the face of a significant uprising or collapse, we face a number of extraordinary risks for what will need to be prepared. And as the pressure mounts and more information gets into North Korea from the outside as a consequence of technological developments, the more likely we are to see such upheaval. In the event there were to be a collapse, China would likely deploy a military force into North Korea to create at the very least a buffer zone in an effort to prevent millions of North Koreans from pouring into China and to avoid having a South Korean military presence on its border. The Republic of Korea would likely ask for our assistance in a move north of the 38th parallel for similar reasons and in an effort to accomplish reunification. The Russians would go on high alert and perhaps take advantage of certain aspects of the situation vis-a-vis the Chinese. And in between, we would have perhaps the worst loose nukes challenge one can imagine, with potentially uncontrolled factions of the DPRK military taking possession of conventional and unconventional weapons to defend themselves against outsiders. And consequently, a key policy initiative that must accompany the pressure campaign intended to lead to a phased approach is intensive contingency planning that ensures we are as prepared as we can be in the event of a regime collapse. Such contingency planning must be done not only with the Republic of Korea, but also with China and, of course, Japan. For everyone should have a clear expectation in the event of the situation deteriorates of what each country's military will do in order to avoid miscalculations and unintended escalation. And strategically, this planning, unlike the effort at the end of World War II that created two Koreas, should be done with the specific intent of reaching an agreement among the United States, the Republic of Korea, Japan, and China regarding an ideal end state that would include a denuclearized peninsula, a unified Korea, and perhaps the removal of, or at least a substantial reduction in, U.S. troops from the peninsula. And besides being the responsible thing to do, an effective contingency plan may have a subtle but important impact on China's calculus regarding pressure. Finally, I come to the third line of effort that I believe should be advanced in parallel to the pressure campaign and contingency planning. This line of effort has three subparts and is focused on the North Korean people. First, it would involve engaging in activities intended to help the people of North Korea when doing so does not significantly detract from the pressure campaign. So, such as providing certain assistance in the event of a natural disaster. Second, it would involve highlighting the human rights abuses of the regime. And third, it would involve getting information to the people of North Korea regarding the outside world. All three are intended to counter, to some extent, the near-constant anti-U.S. propaganda that is fed to the North Korean population, which will remain a serious problem for our national security and foreign policy, even after Kim Jong-un is gone. If we have done nothing to counter the perception, and as we've seen in other foreign policy scenarios, we cannot overestimate the importance of how the population regards the United States if we are to hope to influence events and avoid long-term threats that can develop into unexpected threats in the future. Secondly, the way the first two activities are mutually reinforcing of the pressure campaign and would help us to maintain a multilateral coalition focused on pressure against the regime, as one of the key concerns expressed by certain partners when we ask them to assist us in applying increased pressure on the regime is that the additional sanctions under discussion may hurt the people of North Korea because the elites in the regime will only transfer the loss of revenue rather than suffer themselves. And of course, as I noted at the beginning, these ideas are not new and in fact generally represent an extension of the Obama administration's policy, which appears to have been largely adopted by the Trump administration with some adjustments. In fact, this may be the policy that the Trump administration is pursuing. But if so, I would make a few suggestions on the margins that I believe would increase their chances of success. First, I would avoid engaging in rhetorical barbs with Kim Jong-un, particularly if they are not coordinated with our allies and even China. Without a carefully coordinated approach, the allies are likely to be on edge and will feel unsure of U.S. intentions, which may cause them to take uncoordinated action and ultimately not be as useful a partner as we would hope for in solving this extremely difficult challenge. Moreover, historically, the North would like nothing better than to drive a wedge between the United States and the Republic of Korea, and we should not make their job any easier. Furthermore, such barbs, if not coordinated, can provide an excuse for them to avoid cooperation with us on the enforcement of existing sanctions and development of new ones. Additionally, I don't see the value of such rhetoric in pushing Kim Jong-un toward negotiation. The rhetorical barbs seem far more likely to lead to an unintended escalation of the conflict that ultimately puts our troops on the peninsula in danger. Second, I would coordinate with our allies, first and foremost, and then China to the extent feasible. At the end of the day, we cannot resolve the North Korea challenge without the help of the allies and China. And furthermore, if we're to move forward on the policy initiative outlined above, there are going to be points at which our allies will feel exposed and concerned, and given the threat that they're facing, it's hard to blame them. President Moon has indicated greater willingness than many of his predecessors to engage, and thus is more likely to support the approach I've outlined. But he will be even more supportive if he can trust us to consistently coordinate and tell them what we are doing at every step. With such coordination and trust, the Republic of Korea and Japan are less likely to move towards self-help solutions, such as their own nuclear weapons programs, and more likely to give us room to do things unilaterally that they might otherwise be uncomfortable with, and that might help us to achieve our policy objectives, such as modify our annual military exercises in the context of a freeze. Third, I wouldn't walk away from the Iran deal, as it will send the message that we cannot be trusted to live up to our commitments and will almost certainly make it harder to enter into negotiations with the DPRK over their nuclear program. Now, I'm obviously biased here. I believe the Iran deal was good policy and that it is in the best interest of the United States to support the deal, but I don't intend to turn this into a discussion of the deal. I would just say that if we refuse to hold up our end of the bargain, particularly a commitment made to an adversary regarding their nuclear program, despite the fact that they are complying, I cannot imagine that it would not have an impact on the DPRK's calculus as they consider whether to enter into negotiations with the United States regarding their own program. And at the very least, it would give them greater leverage in the discussions to say that they can't rely on us to follow through on our commitments, and consequently, presumably, they will demand that we front-load our commitments before they're willing to do anything. And certainly Russia and China, who are part of the deal with Iran, will support the North in such comments, given that we will have breached our commitment not only to Iran, but to the P5 countries, which of course includes Russia and China. So finally, I just want to explain something I said at the beginning about why I think this approach is particularly likely to achieve success in the next few years for those who question why pressure, which has yet to bear results, will do so now. I think it's more likely not only because with each successive UN Security Council resolution on sanctions and every other step made since 2006 to increase the pressure on the DPRK, we've slowly ratcheted up the intensity of economic pressure on the DPRK significantly, but also because there are a number of shifts in the landscape, including ones that will help to accelerate and intensify the pressure we bring to bear. First, Kim Jong-un has leaned into fear and intimidation tactics to maintain his authority in ways that far exceed those of his father or grandfather. This is likely the case because he didn't have the years that either of them had to build a network of loyal supporters through the government, and consequently his approach to solidify power was to exercise extraordinary brutality against any perceived threats and thereby deter future threats. This approach, while effective in the short term, carries with it a cost, and one that he is consistently trying to mitigate, and one that consequently may drive him toward a phased approach that carries with it the promise of small economic or legitimacy gains without costing him the program as a whole. Additionally, it is worth noting that his approach to power may ultimately make him more vulnerable to an overthrow and consequently is yet another reason to lean into contingency planning. Second, China has been willing to partner with us more and more in applying pressure to the regime. And while I would attribute this to, in part, a recognition of the fact that the DPRK's pursuit of nuclear weapons continues to have significant downsides, such as a destabilizing impact on the peninsula and driving us to increase our security presence in the region in ways that make them uncomfortable, such as the case with our decision to deploy THAAD missile to the peninsula, I also believe that some of it comes from a very personal irritation among the Chinese elite with the way in which Kim Jong-un has disrespected President Xi and China during the course of his reign. And this disrespect has furthermore highlighted the fact that they are not fully in control of his actions, which may at some point turn against them. Third, advances in technology have made it increasingly difficult for the DPRK to keep its citizens from being exposed to the world outside of the DPRK, which ultimately increases pressure on Kim Jong-un to find ways to strengthen the economy, increase international trade, and gives us greater leverage in pursuing a phased approach, while at the same time making it more likely that eventually the government is overturned. And while with this changing landscape, our diplomacy should have a greater chance for success. And although I share the impatience felt by so many to find a solution to the threat we face from a nuclear-armed North Korea, I also have seen how over time U.S. diplomacy can have an utterly transformative impact on our foreign policy, addressing national security challenges without the loss of life that generally accompanies military action, and which also tends to result in unpredictable and frequently negative long-term consequences. So given the series of bad choices we face, I do think we need to continue to give this approach further time and space to see if we're able to avoid the horror that the chairman spoke of in the context of a military option. Thank you.
Thank you, Avril, for a tremendous presentation. And I'd like to turn the floor to you for any questions.
Coherent in your strategy, and how would the cyber realm play into that your strategy?
Thank you. How would the cyber realm play in? So I let me start by just saying that one of my particular hobby horses has been that we think about cyber sometimes in a stovepipe and not in the context of our broader national security. And I think it's critical to think of cyber just like every other battlefield that we have, essentially, and space within which we have to operate. So within cyber, I think one of the aspects of, obviously, part of what the North Koreans have done in the context of the Sony attack or other things like that is to create irritants and to engage in damaging effects in many respects. And we have to push back against those and create a sort of multilateral coalition to respond to them. So there's those kinds of cyber pieces. But then, of course, more generally, it's just we have to have, as Jake indicated was the true in the context of the Iran deal, a really whole-of-government approach in pursuing our policy, and cyber would certainly be a part of any whole of government approach that we would be engaging in to pursue our policy. Excellent. Thank you.
Yes, let's take several questions.
Thank you, Steve Winters, independent consultant. Just a very brief question. You've emphasized the need to coordinate with Japan and South Korea, also perhaps China, for the eventuality of a collapse in the North. But does that suggest that after all these years, we don't have a coordination yet, that we're not prepared for a collapse in the North? And if not, why not?
Okay. Any others? Yes, in the back.
John Burton with the Korea Times. How much do you think that the North Korean leadership and the North Korean people fear absorption by South Korea, and does that contribute to the stability of the Pyongyang regime?
Okay, so do we have a contingency plan, right? Exactly. Not the one that I spoke of, which is to say that what I'm talking about and suggesting that needs to be done is really developing contingency planning, not just between us and the allies, but also with China in that context. And that's very difficult to do, not the least of which is because it's very hard for China to engage in that kind of contingency planning. Given that their ally is North Korea, right? So, but it's critical, in my view, to actually addressing a situation that I think is at least plausible, to occur at some point. And certainly the extraordinary national security implications of a collapse are worth making a strong effort to address it. But and then to the question of how much do I think a fear among the North Korean population of South Korean absorption leads to Pyongyang's power. I mean, I don't know that I'm the best person to answer the question of what is in the mind of North Koreans per se. But my sense is that there are a lot of factors. I wouldn't have named that as being the most important factor. I think there is a sense among North Koreans, and certainly the leader has indicated such, that the Korean Peninsula should be unified at some point. I think there's an obvious disagreement as to unified under whom. And the North Koreans would say under Kim Jong-un, and obviously the South Koreans would say under President Moon. So I think on both sides there's concern. It's just asymmetric, I suppose, in terms of what the implications of that are. I do think it's more in the sense that there's a fear of invasion of outsiders that is a part of the mentality, and I think it was well expressed by the panel that talked about sort of the bunker mentality that essentially exists within North Korea and the way in which there's a sense that they feel as they are at war, and in fact, as a legal matter, they are, and that is a part of what allows the control to be kept as well.
Thank you.
Patrick?
Thank you. Thank you for this forward-looking speech. I'd like to ask you to look back for just a moment on the Obama administration and the extent to which you can share with us a little bit about some of the USTPRK contacts, as brief as they may have been, with respect to North Korean demands for peace regime or, as you referenced, the freeze for freeze for proposal.
Yeah, very hard to really provide any kind of detailed sort of description of that, I'd say. What I would say is that I think, from my personal perspective, we were not yet at the point where the pressure that was created, even though it continued to get ramped up through successive UN Security Council resolutions and so on, and I think has been successfully ramped up, obviously, further in the Trump administration. At the point that we left, even it was insufficient to really provide the leverage that would be necessary for a phased approach. And I think it's more that you could see the trend lines moving in a certain direction, both with the increase in pressure and some of the things that I highlighted at the end of what I had to say, for why it is that I think that those things are going to just continue to actually help us to accelerate pressure in some respects. So I don't think we were there yet. I don't know that we are there at this moment, frankly, either. I think it may take a little bit more time. I just recognize that it's harder and harder to deal with it. But finally, on contacts, I'd say that my own view is that it's extremely useful to have as many channels as you possibly can. And I do support what I understand to be at least Tillerson's understanding that there are several channels. I hope that's the case.
Thank you for your recommendations. And I just want to ask, since you recently served in the U.S. administration regarding this issue, I guess you wouldn't be able to talk in detail, but you emphasized the importance of coordination with allies. And one of them would be South Korea, obviously, but given the current circumstances, what do you think the Korean government would need to do to ensure greater coordination with the U.S. Trump administration?
This is Joe. I'm a policy consultant. Thanks for the speech. I'm very interested that you mentioned nowadays, probably it's easier for the people in North Korea to access the information from outside, as well as the possibility to even have the Kim Jong authoritarian overthrown in the future. So I want to know a little more details about that. Is there a plan to gather people in North Korea to access more information from the outside, and how would that be handled? Thanks.
Does anyone else want to weigh in? Jung?
Thank you so much, Avril. Is there a particular sequence to your 3 points or three ways forward?
Steve?
Stapleton Roy with the Wilson Center. Could you expand on the concept of a freeze? We have a long history of failed negotiations. We now have a nuclear North Korea. Our negotiating strategy seems to say we need to negotiate something that's urgently necessary, but we take off the table things that might be necessary to get there. I don't see why we should play around with exercises. If it takes us a halt to exercises, a freeze on exercises, why isn't that a good bargain to get a halt to their missile and nuclear testing program? It seems to me we're sort of repeating the same old errors again. We want to accomplish something, but we aren't prepared to give what might be necessary to get there. I'm just interested in comments. That's
maybe we'll take one or two final questions. Evan?
Thank you very much. Avril, I'm a version of a question that was asked earlier of a previous panel. I am curious, given that we may be about to see the Iran deal decertified, what impact do you think that might have on the North Korea issue? Thank you.
And then for a final question, maybe the lady in the back.
Thank you. In regards to a contingency plan, do you see any room for United States-Russia cooperation?
Thank you.
I'm going to get tested on this. I know. Okay. You have to help me if I miss something. Okay. One question was asked about greater cooperation with South Korea, and what advice would I give, I guess, to the South Koreans on this point? I think, in my experience at least, the Republic of Korea and is terrific at, frankly, their outreach to the U.S. government, and I had a very close relationship with my counterpart. I know really everybody around me had close relationships with their counterparts. I think it's important for both sides, obviously, to do everything they can to coordinate, and so I'm hoping that the Trump administration is doing more coordinating than it sometimes appears. But in any event, I do think it's an absolutely critical aspect of any North Korea policy, frankly, that we have. South Korea is our, you know, extraordinary and longstanding ally in the region, and we're not going to be able to solve this without them. So I'm not sure that that's fully satisfying, but it's the best I think I can do. In terms of information coming in to the DPRK and the fact that I think that that may over time, be another pressure point for a possible, revolution of sorts. I think it's clear that there is more information getting in, and I think, frankly, the panel that you heard earlier today for people that have been there are seeing that that's happening. And I'm sure that that's for a variety of reasons, but not the least of which is that technology makes it so much easier now to actually get information into places that otherwise, might have been essentially kept isolated by a government. I do think that that creates a couple of different pressures, one of which is, I think, the one that was outlined that I also mentioned in my speech, I think, which is essentially that as people see how other people are living, right, in other countries, there is a desire, there's sort of a recognition of the current situation is really bad and just how bad, in a sense, and a desire to get more materials and other things from outside. And that puts pressure, I think, on Kim Jong-un to deliver, in some respects, to the elites, but also more generally. And I think that gives us a potential opening for the phased approach point that I was trying to make earlier. I do think also just in the kind of conversation that was had earlier also about how things worked with the Soviet Union and watching that develop, I think the information coming in from the outside was a part of what led to the internal pressures that essentially caused its combustion. So I think that's those are what I'm thinking of when I'm talking about those issues. Then in terms of your question about the sequence, I see all of these as three lines of effort that you're doing at the same time. So I think, I put the first line of effort as pressure leading to a phased approach, and I think we still have some space to go before we really can get to the conditions under which, but I'm not in a position, obviously, right now to tell. And that's for, the administration to kind of work through. At the same time, I think we need to be engaging with our allies on everything, but then also, I think, on contingency planning. And I believe that as we've seen the shift in China occur just a little bit, and, you know, I think it's the question of how much is a good one and whether or not there's a point at which it won't shift any further. I think you really want to lean into contingency planning to see if they're willing to do it. And then, frankly, as I said, I believe that in some respects, if you were to get to a point where you actually had a contingency plan that China was, you know, part of a discussion on, it may shift their view on the degree of pressure they're willing to put on North Korea, because so much of their concern is an existential crisis of what happens if they destabilize North Korea so much that they end up with millions of refugees on their border and destabilizing of the peninsula, et cetera. So that's at least a piece of it. And then finally, I really think what I believe is sometimes overlooked, but a critical piece of the policy, is focusing on the North Korean people and thinking about how are they perceiving us? What does that look like over the years? I think that's, you know, maybe less of a short-term and more of a long-term strategy, but one that I think is critical, and we're going to be facing it at some point. So in any event, those three. Okay, then why not stop the exercises? Yes, okay. So this is a very good question. What? No. But why not trade it for a negotiation?
Right.
Why not say that again? Why not take them off? Yeah.
We want to negotiate a halt, but no exercises. They can't be part of it.
Right. That's entirely fair. I am not suggesting that we shouldn't be willing to have a conversation about the exercises. My concern about a freeze for a freeze, in the way that it's been termed, and the offer essentially that I indicated is on the table, is that I think it's insufficient, right? So I think one is, you know, North Korea is engaging in illegal activity in testing nuclear weapons, doing, you know, ballistic missile tests that are against UN Security Council resolutions. What we're doing in our exercises is making sure that we're ready to protect our ally, i.e. the Republic of Korea, in the event of an attack, right? So I don't see these two as equivalent in that sense. What I do think is that it is possible to consider modifications, maybe even substantial modifications, to the exercises that alleviate some of the frustration and concerns that the North Koreans raise in that context, while at the same time preserving our capability to be ready to protect our ally. And I think that's a perfect example of a place where you'd really need to coordinate with the Republic of Korea, because part of what you're doing is not just dealing with the freeze piece, but also making sure that the Republic of Korea feel sufficiently reassured in the situation that they're also not engaging in escalatory behavior that creates a problem in that situation as well. So that would be my thought on that. Evan, you asked about the Iran deal. I mentioned it in my talk. I absolutely think that, you know, even aside from, you know, an argument over the merits of the deal, which I obviously support, but putting that aside, as was earlier indicated, I just think we are shooting ourselves in the foot if we pull out of a deal where we have, you know, we negotiated over a nuclear program with an adversary, they are complying with it, and we've decided to walk away from it. It's the wrong message to be sending to the North Koreans. As you're saying, you're exercising pressure to drive them to the table to have a negotiation over a nuclear deal. So that would be an issue. Russia, is that right? What was the question?
Cooperating with Russia.
Thank you. Yes. Oh, in the contingency plan. Could I imagine them in the contingency plan cooperating? Yeah, I could imagine the discussion. And I debated myself whether or not to include them in the group of countries that I think it's important to negotiate a contingency plan with. But I honestly think it's more important to be focused on the Republic of Korea, Japan, and China. It's not that it's irrelevant, but I think those are the key countries that you really need to work through contingency planning. And I think to bring Russia into that in early stages, and I think, frankly, this is the kind of thing that would have to be done behind closed doors, not something you're doing publicly, but I think to bring them into that discussion early on is probably a mistake. It's a disruptor. It's not necessarily useful. I do agree with, I think, the point that was made earlier by Jonathan, that I do see Russia as being the wild card in many respects to how things develop, and that will be very interesting. It's hard to predict for a number of reasons, but it's something to watch, obviously, in this landscape. Is that it?
Tremendous. You answered every question. Thank you. Please join me in welcoming and thanking Avril for a tremendous presentation.
Thank you, Avril. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you to everyone who spoke today, and especially to our tremendous staff, Hunter, Maeve, Paul, Aileen, Ryan, and everybody who helped out with this event. We're very grateful for your support and for your participation. And we just wanted to let you know that this problem is ongoing, and Brookings will be hard at work in our Korean Peninsula Working Group on answering some of these questions that were posed by our panelists and by you, the audience. So thank you very much, and please join me in thanking the panelists.